This interview was brought to you by the Omega Center. The Omega Center is an online forum striving to facilitate a deepening of consciousness, conversation, and connection as we seek God in our scientific age. The website is dedicated to education, formation, and inspiration in the converging fields of science and theology, and exists to support the work of author and theologian Ilya Delio.
Thank you so much for joining us. I am interviewing Edwin Olson for the Omega website today, and we're having a conversation about his book, And God Created Wholeness, A Spirituality Catholicity, where he's exploring the implications at the quantum basis of our physical well-being, our consciousness, and our spirituality. Edwin, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
So I thought we would get started, as we typically do, by having you share a little bit about your book and the topic, and then what drew you to this topic, and we can take it from there.
Okay. Well, I must go back a few years. I've been working to understand this whole science and religion dialogue that's been going on for, of course, a long time, but I've been doing this about 10 years. I've written a couple books to try to get at it in various ways. And then I came across this book by a quantum biologist and quantum physicist called Life on the Edge. And they present a model, a way of understanding life that is very, very compelling, because here we have empirical scientific proof that life is dependent upon a connection to the quantum level, where all kinds of amazing things can happen at the same time. Things can are connected and affect each other when far apart, and things can tunnel through barriers. Particles can tunnel through barriers very quickly, and so on. So the research is based on studies of photosynthesis and bird migration and our sense of smell and other things. So the model that they presented suggested that there's, at the surface level that we experience day to day, the activities in our bodies, the cells, and so on, really are dependent to a connection of quantum activity. And as I looked at that, it really struck me, this is really a powerful metaphor of what may be happening in our consciousness, in our mind, and also as we experience spiritual things. And so I developed a model. I call it a model, the wholeness model, that uses that the three-tier model that the biologists present to speculate as a strong metaphor. But I think even in the consciousness area, it's a bit more than a metaphor, because there's a lot of research going on, as you probably know, about consciousness. So I'm finding it very, very helpful on various levels, personally, for an individual's self-development, and for relationships, and even more broadly, looking more broadly at what happens in society and how it's important to be connected to that very deep level where amazing things can happen. And one of the things that helped me get confidence that this is worth talking about and speculating about is, as I looked at the mystics, especially Evelyn Underhill's work and others, that as they describe the process of going deep in meditation and so on, it's the same kind of process that I describe in this book of what may be going on at all three dimensions of body, mind, and soul.
Yeah, it's fascinating that, you know, quantum physics, quantum biology is like the hot new science that everybody is like really interested in at an amateur level knowing about. So if you could kind of explain for us a little bit about what quantum biology is and what would be a lay person's capacity to understand why it's so exciting, why it's so different. I believe Albert Einstein said about quantum physics, that it was like spooky science because it doesn't operate by the normal rules. And so if you could share a little bit for our audience, why is this such a revolutionary thing? Why is this so important? And what's happening right now with this?
Well, scientists have known for a long time that that quantum activity is going on. But in one way, it's really something we don't comprehend, and maybe not even have to deal with, because we can explain things pretty well by looking at cellular activity and so on without going down to the quantum level. But what the biologists now have found is that we can, in fact, usefully understand and maybe affect what's happening at that level. For example, I didn't know this when I started this, but MRI machines, for example, really are dependent upon activity at the quantum level to work. I mean, when those magnets go off, make all that racket, what they're doing is getting the hydrogen atoms to line up. And that's when they take a picture. And of course, all of the activity now going on about looking at a quantum computing as qubits and all of that is, I think, getting interest in people to really understand more about what that activity is and how we can relate to it more usefully.
It's almost to me like a Narnia trap door to this other world that in some ways we maybe have had a human intuition about for a long time. Like you mentioned the mystics, that I even think about great writers like Lewis or Tolkien or, that feed our imagination and think in ways that describe realities that don't necessarily align with what we've been told our reality looks like. Right. But this understanding that there is this deeper secret functioning world in the midst of our world, you're saying in your book and on your blog for the Omega Center, that there's a connection between that, the secret happenings of this deeper quantum world and what's happening at the surface level. Could you share a little bit more about that insight?
Yeah. The biologists point out that that when atoms are doing all of these weird things, they call this coherence. This is a circumstance where large numbers of particles are cooperating. And I've been, in the book, I kind of argue that perhaps in deep meditation and prayer, we enter into a coherent state of consciousness and spirit that is then manifested in our intuitions and dreams. Mm. And the idea of being connected to the surface down to the bedrock, there's this middle layer. I haven't mentioned that. But so the three-tier model is surface, middle, and bedrock. Now, the surface is the activity of our daily going about doing things, things that we construct and so on. In the middle level, this is where biologically all kinds of turbulence is going on, where there's a lot of noise, in effect, as molecules bump into each other and so on. And then at the bedrock is where this quantum activity is. And what the biologists argue is that really the cells in our body somehow are able to navigate that noise in that middle layer and maintain that coherent connection to what's going on at the quantum level. And when that connection is lost, that's when death occurs. That's when cells die, basically. So again, as a metaphor, I look at, well, what's going on in our consciousness and our mind as we deal with emotions and feelings and images and dreams. That's the stuff in the middle. And so understanding that what happens if we get connected at that deep level, that does influence what our feelings and emotions are at the middle level, and then that moves up into the surface level where we take action, where things concrete, tangible things can happen.
Mm. So at the middle level, would you say that is the realm of interpretation of where, you know, we're getting these insights, dreams, sensations, feeling, an embodied feeling, you're saying all of that is part of the middle level of just the noise between these two other kind of bookmark layers.
Right. That's where we start to make sense of these deep stirrings that are there. So if we look at it, you know, spiritually, we have a sense of a divine presence. Something is really going on at a very deep level in our soul. And then as we begin to reflect on that and that begins to affect our emotional level, how we begin to think about things, and then that translates into our service activity.
Yeah, what I find interesting is the ways that as these things get translated to the surface activity, we build constructs at that level, right?
Yes,
so we create narratives and paradigms and
cultures
and society gets built at this very surface level.
Yeah.
And then we really adhere to those constructs. We become deeply identified with them.
Right.
In essence, what we do when we become deeply identified with those constructs is we're disconnecting then from what you're describing as this quantum bedrock of ultimate potentiality and possibility. And we adhere more and more. No, 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 this is how things need to be.
Right.
Yeah, and in essence, disconnect ourselves, yeah?
Exactly. But see, that's idolatry. That's ego really saying this is what I want. This is wanting to be in control, which, you know, we need to survive. And we need to have a measure of control and ego and so on. But when we just live on the surface and live in that ego state, inflated ego state, yeah, mm-hmm. that's when we lose that connection.
I feel like I'm probably speaking for a lot of listeners when I say that it's very clear that what we're going through right now as not just in our country, but I think in the entire world seems to be one of those moments of recognizing that we've so adhered to certain systems that are no longer connected to that deeper bedrock flow of life. And we're feeling the malaise and the nausea of that. And, you know, I think about religion too, and what you're saying is really profound, because in a way it's requiring us to think differently about how we think about our faith. In other words, if we really are to, you know, be connected to that bedrock, we almost always have to then continually be releasing and letting go of the constructs that we're building at the surface level, which is very hard to do.
Hard, yeah. That's the challenge that a mystic faces, is being able to go deep. But let me just quote a little bit from Matthew Fox, which I mentioned in the books.
Because
he's in his book on Meister Eckhart, he argues that Meister Eckhart insists that we do more than just rub the surface dimensions of culture and self, that mm-hmm. we must go deeply to the edge of our understanding and experience. We need to go down deep into the darkness, into the mystery, into the shadow, into the forgotten parts of ourselves as individuals and communities and as a species. We must then also come back to the surface, change, and ready to make change.
Mm-hmm.
The future requires all of us to dive deep and return, surfacing with the wisdom, the mysteries, and the truths we learned from diving. Mm-hmm. So in the book, I talk about cycling, and I really see, and I've been doing this now in my own spiritual practice, thinking of this as a cycling process live on the surface, but it's almost like, pray without ceasing, kind of, you know, some mm-hmm. of that kind of thinking, putting it in religious language, that but rather than just count on my ego to be able to discern what's important, to be able to try to go deep, reflect, and see what the unconscious will surface. Mm-hmm. So of course I have a background in Jungian work, and I do a lot of dream work, so that's one way I think we're tied into this deep level, dreams and images that surface there indications of what's happening at that deep level. And so we can tap into the wisdom of the dreams or, active imagination that we have. It really helps us, I think, discern what's important on the surface.
Mm. And we don't really do it very much anymore. You know, I think as a society, we've gotten so obsessed with our rational boxes, our empirical data, like give me something quote unquote solid, which is ironic. Of course, there's nothing solid. But we really like that, you know, and I think what strikes me about what you're saying is that, you know, the mystics have been describing through the ages this path, this journey that you're describing of into the darkness, into the deep. I mean, we even have it in the Christian narrative of Jonah being swallowed by a giant fish and taken, you know, the belly of the whale, you know. So this idea that we do have to cycle and dive into the depths so that we can return transformed and change what's on the surface. And yet it's a mechanism that for us as human beings is very difficult to move into a space of unknowing, of not knowing, of uncertainty. It's a very destabilizing process. And so this is where I think, you know, these practices, these spiritual disciplines or practices and meditation are developing some of that capacity. And you just named dream work. So I kind of want to ask you a little bit more about dream work, if that's okay. You know, it's curious to me, particularly in the Christian tradition, when dreams played such a huge role in so many of the narratives and stories that we have, where did that go?
Right.
Because now, you know, to say to somebody, you know, I had a really powerful dream, and they look at you and they'd probably be like, well, what did you eat last night? You know, right. There's no spiritual sense, or there's no, we're not really bestowing meaning so much anymore in these liminal spaces that you're describing of what happens in the middle. What's your perspective on that? Like, what could you say to somebody like me who's like, whatever happens, dream interpretation is a valid thing?
Well, it is difficult because certainly, you know, there are cultures, some of the native cultures, you know, the Aborigine culture live in dream time or give a lot of importance to that. Mm-hmm. Journaling, I think, is one way to help tap into that. A person is reluctant to pay attention to dreams, begin to reflect and pay attention to what's happening during the day and images that maybe just pop in out of nowhere. You know, people say like, gee, sometimes I'm taking a shower, I get this insight, a eureka moment, you know. So where does that come from? where do these insights come from? They come from a very deep place. And so I don't think it's, you know, we're not just dependent on dreams. I think even in a waking time, we can have these insights are there. It's being willing to pay attention to them, though. I think writing them down helps a lot.
Yeah. It's the world of metaphor, isn't it? They're like these symbols and that rise up in the unconscious. And I think perhaps what's taking place is as we recognize that pure quote unquote rationality, the emphasis of only the empirical isn't really providing us with the meaning that we seek, or to use a term that you're using from a quantum perspective, the coherence that I think we intuitively know is there and are wanting to tap into. And I really like how you connected this. You've said this already, but I just want to read this line in your blog where you say, with deep meditation and prayer, is it possible that we can enter a coherent state where large numbers of particles in our soul are cooperating with and affecting something far from us? So this idea of entanglement, which has become so popular, but you're bringing a new layer of meaning and depth to that with the quantum perspective that there's coherence happening, that when we get into that state of deep meditation or prayerfulness, we are actually participating in coherence.
Yes. Yeah. We are connected in ways that, you know, we don't even know. I think it's hard for people to sometimes grasp entanglement because they think, well, how can something here influence something hundreds of miles away, instantaneously. That'd be faster than the speed of light. And mm-hmm. There's really nothing faster than the speed of light that we know. But if you think of it as like if you had a stick, so one end of the stick is here and the other end of the stick is 100 miles away. If you turn the stick, the other end turns instantly, mm-hmm. right? So it's that connectedness that we have that, is really very important to understand.
Well, and I think, but part of our problem is that perhaps we don't realize that we're operating with the old set of the old paradigm as our lens. We're still thinking in very Newtonian terms, where we picture reality like a grid, and that there's space between every person, and that molecules have space between this. So there's lots of room for everybody. There's just a lot of spaciousness, and everything is very individual. And there's this cause and effect idea, like, little marbles bumping in these things, So I think that that's part of what is a barrier for so many of us to actually grasp, when in reality, the way that you're describing it, it's far more like swimming in the same ocean. And the feeling you have of somebody swirling nearby you, it impacts you, that yes. every movement that we're taking is actually creating a swirling activity around us. And in ways impacting the world and the cosmos in ways that we can't even really fully grasp.
Right. Yeah, I think, if you even think back to biblical times, St. Paul writing, "I am with you in spirit." I mean, that's, as he went to the different churches around and so on, he felt connected with them, mm-hmm. And I think it's that sense that that we are connected, that many people of faith can tap into that. Mm.
And you talk about moving through barriers as tunneling. Can you tell us more about tunneling? Because that's quite an image that's being built in my mind. I'm like picturing like a little burrowing animal.
Well, yeah, that electrons, for example, in structures of atoms and the particles in our body, they can just be in multiple places at the same time. So it's like there is no barriers. I mean, they say tunneling, but it's almost like forget the idea of barrier. Mm. And so again, as a metaphor, when you think about that breaking down barriers, if at the quantum level there are no barriers, and so if we think of our mind be able to leap from one thing to the other and connect even to, a divine kind of presence. Mm-hmm. It's all connected there. So in a way, tunneling, there's just, it's an open gate. People just, you can just go from here to there very quickly.
So instead of tunneling, we should just say unbarriering.
Yeah, unbarrier. Yes, I think so.
There's no barrier to begin with.
Right.
But that's, again, it's so interesting because we are so identified as separate, and we do really hold to the surface level of interpretation. And so let's talk about that at a more practical level. You mentioned in your book, if we don't own and examine our deeply embedded unconscious societal attitudes that give rise to the violence, racism, sexism and homophobia on the surface, we're in peril in the short term. And that in the longer term, if we don't acknowledge our deep suppressed feeling of alienation and abandonment, or our pursuit of wealth, our technological prowess and consumer satiation, it will do us in. And so I think what you're saying is that, this isn't just at a theoretical level, that at a very practical level, at the surface, if we continue to adhere to only surface reality, we really are kind of destroying ourselves in a certain sense.
Right. Yeah. We have to, capture that wisdom or tap into that wisdom that's very deep. And there's some examples I mentioned in the book of, part of my background, I used to do a lot of diversity training in organizations. Mm-hmm. And I remember we were called in by this one organization. Actually, it was a government agency. And the HR director said, the reason he wants to start this diversity program is he woke up the other night drenched in sweat, his dream was all about how he was oppressing the blacks in the agency, all of the people of color, and he just was shaken to his core. And so that's an example of some stirring, dramatic, at the bedrock that then led to his action at the surface to initiate a program to get rid of or diminish the amount of discrimination in his agency.
But even at a collective level, how do we impact the systemic surface thinking?
That's a tough one. I mean, we're caught up in this dream. There's the one organization that I've been affiliated with, the Pachamama Alliance, talks about, you know, the dream of the North, in the world, is this consumer-driven kind of thing that's destroying, you know, our rainforests and a lot of the natural resources in the world. And we need to awaken from this dream that we're in, this collective dream. And I think if you think about other societal issues, these days we're thinking about, you know, the issue of safety and security, you know, the gun culture and so on. I mean, there's like almost a myth that we have tapped into collectively. And how do you, the changes, how do you change that at a societal level is huge. But sometimes, and I learned this from my work in chaos theory and complexity, sometimes a small event can have a huge impact. You know, you think of Rosa Parks, you know, on the bus, and that, you know, was one of the triggers to the big civil rights changes and so on. So I think we have to be alert for those moments when the conditions are just right for some small thing and small little spark can, you know, lead to a huge change. And we've seen huge changes. I mean, the whole issue of, you know, of same-sex marriage and so on, you know, how public attitudes on some of these issues have shifted very quickly. Mm-hmm. So it's possible, but the conditions have to be right for it. Mm-hmm. We're locked into, I think, you know, the two-party system right now, which is so, you know, split and ideologically, you know, polarized, it makes it tough to find an opening there, you know. So.
Yeah, but I really appreciate what you're saying. It's a real invitation to each of our listeners to say, on the one hand, you could sit there and just look at these systems on the surface level and be so discouraged. Yeah. And just be like, okay, well, you know what, I'm just going to dive down and live the rest of my life, you know, hanging out in the deep with the quantum potentiality, because, like, it really sucks up here. But, you know, but what you're saying is that as we dive into those depths and come back transformed ourselves, that we are better equipped to be the agents of coherence, making, you know, wholeness, as you're describing, in moments when it can really kind of shift the entire system. And without that depth, there isn't really the hope then that, you know, when I was describing this to somebody recently, we were talking about, you know, what really changes systems and what's a systemic change agent look like, you know? And I said, it's almost like you have to realize that you're swimming in dirty water before you can actually change or mention to everybody, like, hey, did you guys notice this water's kind of dirty? Like, you know, so sometimes I think about our personal work that we do in our practices as diving into the depths so that we can see, oh, hey, at the surface level, things are really not so clear. But we ourselves have to have a sense, an experience, almost like a body memory of clarity to be able to offer clarity.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah, I like the way you said that. Yeah, to find that coherence. Because then I think, then we can come to the surface and we can engage in dialogue. We can be confronting without being confronted. We're, you know, making people defensive. So I think if we are, you know, centered in ourself, confident in where we're operating out of. Some people have talked about a new operating system, but we individually and collectively.
That
is based more on our wisdom from deep within. And our connection to others that are also there. I think if we can begin to do that more collectively, in groups, for example. And I see that in church groups, for example, where you have a group of adult learners, for example, coming together, reading some of all the new stuff that's coming out, and as a group beginning to develop a collective understanding.
A new way of thinking.
Yeah,
I appreciate that, you know, because what you're saying is essentially we need to be courageously creative. In other words, when we dive into the depths, what's happening is we're diving into ultimate potentiality of what we can't even imagine could be, because we're so used to operating at a surface level where what we see is what we think is the only possibility. And in many ways, we live out of reaction to that. And when we're in reaction, we're not really creating anything new. We're just in reaction. You know, so I love that quote that Richard Rohr says, that, you know, the opposite of contemplation isn't action, it's reaction. And so to really live a life of true contemplative action or true courageous creativity, it does require us to disengage from reality as we think it is, and to experience a glimpse of the potential of what it could be.
Right, yeah.
Well, this has been such an inspiring conversation. I like to ask a lot of the people that I interview, if it's okay with you, is there a practice that you like to engage in that helps you dive into the bedrock realm that we could share with our listeners?
Well, actually, in the book, I kind of mentioned that there's kind of some simple rules that if one can, you know, develop a discipline, of course, and this is very hard for me to take time out to meditate and so on. That's one of the hardest things that I do. So, but what I try to do regularly is continually kind of assess what's going on the surface. You know, seeing glimmers of hope, also glimmers of possibilities and so on. Because I think, you know, putting it into religious language, you know, if you think of God as active, you know, at all of these levels of this model of surface, middle, and so on, there's always the spirit and so on is active. So always kind of assess what's going on, but then try to go below the surface, realizing what's emerging, that there are these forces in the universe that are wanting to be born, to bring in new light into what's going on, and then make relationships. I think is so important with others, other people, connect to other ideas, see the interdependence that we have, you know, with others. And so in that process, what I sometimes find is I experience something that transcends my understanding of reality, you know, that there's something more. And I talk about that with people and together. Well, like this interview, I mean, I really like the way you phrased a lot of things. I look forward to going back and listening to it.
Oh, good.
It's a learning process, you know, but I think, yeah, we can't do it alone. We have to do it in connection with others. So
that's so powerful. It's relationship actually that helps mirror the deeper facets of reality for us, right? You know, like I think maybe one way to translate that into a practice is even just being able to ask ourselves as we're going through our day. You know, I'm fascinated by disruption, for instance, you know, so sometimes I'll ask myself, like, what's disrupting me right now? Like, what's going on? You know, and if I answer that once, I get a very surface answer, you know, I'll probably be like, well, you know, the guy cut me off and I was in a bad mood and whatever. And it's like, no, what's disrupting? And you ask the question again, and then you kind of get a little bit deeper. You're like, oh, well, actually it's the fact that, you know, I really had an experience that I didn't anticipate and it caught me off guard. Or, you know, you go deeper and deeper and then you realize like, oh, I'm kind of going through a rough time right now where I'm feeling very isolated. Maybe what I need to do is actually, instead of just stay in that isolation, reach out and be vulnerable with somebody about that, you know? So I think asking ourselves these questions is kind of taking your practice into a practical approach, because it's a powerful practice to dive beneath the surface of our activities, to take time every day to just kind of do an inventory or an inquiry as to, okay, what's underneath this? Mm-hmm. I once knew someone who would always ask this question. They would say, what's the question beneath your question right now?
Oh, good. Yeah.
Which is a helpful way to kind of be like, okay, it's just acknowledging that underneath this surface level, there's other things going on. And if we can keep diving into that, if we can keep relaxing ourselves enough to dive into that, and we might be surprised to discover that there's something, some new potential there, something from the bedrock that we can take back to the surface of our lives.
Yeah. And I think, you know, connecting to nature is really helpful in that regard. I've just been reading, there's a new book out by Lisa Sedaris on consecrating science, where she talks about wonder, knowledge in the natural world.
Oh, wow.
And of course, her whole thing, she's been arguing against some of these grand narratives like the journey of the universe and so on, using a cosmic model to understand things at sort of this big conceptual level. And she argues that really what's important is that we really get down to the level that we inhabit with our senses, where we really, you know, encounter the world in all of its variety. So she's encouraging many narratives, various narratives from all kinds of traditions and religions and so on, rather than trying to build one grand narrative that there's that, and she thinks, you know, being connected to nature is really helpful.
That's so powerful and so important, especially right now, to be cognizant of context and to allow many different contexts to exist at the same time.
Yes.
And then also to deeply embody our own context. You know, I think most of the time we're probably living at the surface because we're just really deeply disconnected from our own bodies and from our own selves.
Yes.
So we're just acting unconsciously because we haven't even slowed down enough to feel anything beneath our, you know, neck. It's like we've become very Cartesian in our like understanding of reality. It's like, wait, there's more to me than just what I think. I don't understand. So I can understand how going, you know, being in nature is another wonderful practice of slowing down, of connecting to our senses, and in a way of unknowing, diving into that depth of unknowing that the mystics talk about, sort of suspend our disbelief a little bit and experience reality at that deeper connected level of coherence.
Yes.
Well, we're so deeply grateful for the time that you took out of your day to talk to us, and especially very grateful for your work and your new book, In God Created Wholeness, a spirituality Catholicity. Edwin, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Oh, thank you, Bree. It's been really, really wonderful. I really learned a lot. As I said, I look forward to seeing what we said together.
Yeah.
And, because I'm working on, you know, a new book and so on. And I've always got looking for, gee, where do I go from here with this?
So, yeah, well, wonderful. Good. Yeah. So there's some coherence afoot already.
Right. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.